Welcome to Afterlives of Ancient Egypt, in which we discuss ancient history and relevant current events. I'm Kara Cooney, and I love to take deep dives into history that are not always possible in academic formats. So let's get started. Hello, dear listeners, and welcome back to another episode of Afterlives of Ancient Egypt with me, your host, Kara Cooney, and a special guest, part two, with Neil Laird, who is an amazing producer of historical archaeological television programs. And we're just getting the down low on how these TV programs work and what the future of these TV programs might be, what it's like to work within a personality-driven medium, what the demographics are that watch these things, what the money is, and all of these things we'll discuss. So let's start, Neil, with a little introduction from you. And this is, of course, part two, so our listeners will know you already. But for those jumping in at this point, who are you?
It's a good question. Let's see. I mean, we did talk a bit, I think, the first time about making my first film in Egypt. But I think one thing that certainly, I think, kept me in the business was this love of ancient history, particularly of Egypt. I grew up in a small Catholic area, Catholic school and outside of Pittsburgh, and we learned nothing of ancient history. I think we lumped all of pre-Roman history in one afternoon before geography class. So I didn't get into that kind of stuff when I grew up. So I was sort of in the dark about all that stuff. And I was always enamored of, I always knew as a kid I wanted to make movies, but I thought I was going to do fiction films. So I went to Temple University in Philadelphia, and I got my bachelor's in TV and in film production. And then I moved to New York thinking I'd become Martin Scorsese overnight, that instantly they'd recognize this brilliant talent with a bachelor's of arts in his hand and they'd add a McMillan. That did not work. Instead, I was a poor schlub holding a walkie-talkie on the set of Toxic Avenger 4 at 3 in the morning to make sure they didn't steal the grip truck.
Toxic Avenger 4?
Might have been 3. They do blur.
3? I don't know.
That was the good one. That was the better one, I think.
Yeah. There is an interesting IMDb of me for RoboCop 2, but that's only because there's another Kara Cooney, Kara with a K, Cooney with a C, in Houston, Texas, who was on the set as a PA for RoboCop 2, but it was not me. So you can IMDb that shit.
Opportunity, Kara.
I know. But it was not me. But you guys can Google it. Go Google the name Kara Cooney and you will find that RoboCop 2. And I think it is on my IMDb instead of her IMDb. It's too bad.
I know there's a Neil Laird golf historian that I get confused with a lot too. People hit me up asking about golf and you know what? It's a pretty thin response.
So if you started out with a film degree, how did you end up moving into history TV, archaeology TV? Did it just happen?
Because there was so little work. I moved to New York City, a production assistant, a gaffer or whatever, the lone person on the totem pole, and you wait for jobs. And this was the late 80s or something, and there were very few jobs. So I had nothing else to do and very little money. So I started hanging out at the New York Public Library because it was free. And I could sit there all day long in the air conditioning and take out books. And for some reason, one day I picked up a book off the shelf about Neolithic civilization, which I had never learned anything about before. And I took it back and I read it, and it just, something, a penny dropped, and I became fascinated by this forgotten, ancient, prehistoric world. So I resolved to teach myself history through the New York Public Library. And I read book after book after book, waiting for the phone to not ring. And then when I got to Egypt, though, I got stuck. Something about Egypt, I couldn't get past Egypt. I became so enamored of the Egyptian civilization. And Indus Valley and Mesopotamia, I love too, those early cultures. But Egypt really enraptured me. And I think I must have read about 15 books, anything I could, all the way back to like E. Wallace Budge from 1903 and all these dusty tomes that were way in the back of the library. But so much so that at some point I said, screw it, I don't want to wait around for Toxic Avenger 4. So I poured on my money and I backpacked to the Middle East. And I wandered around for probably 4 or 5 months. Went to Israel, of course, Egypt, Turkey, Syria, Jordan, tried to get into Iran, but couldn't. But when I came back, my head was so high in the clouds from seeing especially Saqqara and the Valley of the Kings that I said, how the hell can I get someone to pay me to go back and do this on the regular? So I went back and got my master's in documentary film with the thinking that I would go make historical films, which is actually surprising, is actually what I did. And I pulled it off and I made my thesis film about the Great Sphinx of Egypt, which I think we talked about in the last podcast. But really, it was just something that just kind of hit me really hard, like out of nowhere. And I've been totally consumed with this world and this culture and this history ever since.
Did you create your own company? What did you do? Or did you work for other people's companies? You were there as a producer, storyteller for other people's work?
Yeah, early on, how did you do it? I did a few Egypt shows. A lot of shows. I did everything. I did a few Egypt shows, but I also did weight loss shows and shipwreck shows and a game show or two. I mean, you did whatever you can. So it wasn't like I could be so selective. All I'm going to do is shows about Ramses the Great. Sadly, that didn't happen. As I got moved up in my career, by the time I got to National Geographic and then Discovery, I was sort of known as the history guy in the ancient history. And those shows always rate. So I'd say the last 5 years at Discovery, I probably worked on over 100 hours of television that almost all was about ancient history.
What's your most popular, famous, well-known episode, series, things like this?
I mean, it's a good question. I think the show we worked in, Digging for the Truth, had a nice run because that was an archaeology show. The two most popular shows that I did at Science Channel weren't necessarily Egypt, but there was one, and they're still on, and they're a very simple show. We call them Channel Chow sometimes because they're so, you just can keep making more and more and more of them. And I remember when this treatment crossed my desk, I says, this is a brilliant idea that can run forever, and it has. And it's a show called What on Earth, which is still on Science Channel and now on Discovery. And what it is simply, you see a satellite photo from the air, the beginning of every segment, and say, what on earth is this? The quick bird satellite is flying over Central Asia, and it captures this image. What is it? And then it kind of becomes a game. You know, is it Genghis Khan's lost tomb? Is it a Soviet bunker? Or is it just, you know, Marge Callahan's backyard, whatever.
So it's kind of like a combination of Wordle plus sat images plus
it's fun to kind of play along thing. But what's great is then you can get into history and can talk a little about Genghis Khan, a little about Hitler, all in 10 minutes. And people, what I discovered from television is, it's not surprising because TV viewers, they want the information, but not lots of it.
They want to be passive.
They want to be passive and they want to be able to dip in and out. Mm-hmm. And be interested, but if they leave the room to go walk the dog for 10 minutes, they don't want to rewind. They want to think they can pick it right back up. Not all of them. So it has to kind of be bite-sized stuff. So you can't go too deeply down a historical rabbit hole. So you have to, but one thing you do is you ask questions and mystery. Almost all of the shows that I did have a mystery. The what is it? What on Earth is a perfect example of just taking that down to its essence and just kind of creating just a mystery about a mysterious mound in Scotland. We already know what it is. The National Parks of Scotland can tell you, oh, yeah, that's Newgrange. You know, we won't tell you that until the end.
And so but you're
watching. It's the kick.
Yeah. And then so getting back to Egypt, what was the first TV series or show you got to do in Egypt?
That was my thesis. I mean, that's the one that got me in, is the one, the Great Sphinx of Egypt, where at that time they were restoring the Sphinx. I don't know if you remember that. This was the late 90s. If you were active over there or not, Mark Lehner and Zahi Hawass. And the Italians had done a real botched job in the early 80s restoring, and they used modern day cement. And the Sphinx is essentially repelling it. So they're pushing these stones out. You can literally see those like little Lego blocks being repelled from the mother rock. So the timing was great because I had a friend on the Antiquities Board. I was just a kid in school, but a good friend of mine who's a filmmaker, Hisham Asawi in Cairo today, his father was on the Antiquities Board. He's a geologist, great guy. And he helped me pull some strings. He was Zahi's mentor. So he opened some doors and got us free permits and stuff. So we went over there with school equipment and we clambered over the Sphinx for 2 or 3 weeks following Mark Lehner and Zahi. But the great thing about that show, the thing that I remember so much, and I think this kind of informed a lot of my documentary since, it's great to have the Egyptologist, but it's so wonderful to have the local people, the stonemasons and the artists. And when I got there, the character that I was most compelled by was the stonemason named Saeed El-Mashashi, who was just the stonemason from East Cairo and wearing the galabi and everything. Didn't speak a word of English. I didn't speak any Arabic. But it was fascinating to watch him work. And the idea was they were using their traditional ancient styles. I think that's probably putting too fine a point on it, but they were taking all these stones out, carving. They went to the quarry. The quarry down south of Cairo. They got all the stones.
That's the Tura quarry for the limestone stuff.
So they got the stones from the same place they got the Giza pyramid stones, and they used them and they cut them as much as they could based on what they thought it looked like in the New Kingdom restoration. And of course, it had been repaired so many times. There was a New Kingdom, there was a Ptolemaic, and then even a later period. So they kind of used all the different stones and tried to keep it in place. So I probably shot way more than I needed to because I was just a naive kid. I just kept the camera rolling and rolling and rolling. We had like 500 hours for a 40-minute show.
And you're this is video. You are doing video.
Oh, this is all video. This is all.
You know, thank God.
Yeah, this is all video. None of this is film. This is school camera. I think I told that last time. Our school equipment, which wasn't allowed to leave the city of Chicago.
And we you brought it to Egypt.
We took it to the Giza Plateau for like two bloody weeks.
That's amazing. And of course, right after that, though you didn't get this scoop, was the Charlton Heston NBC documentary, and I use documentary in scare quotes, that's then saying the Sphinx is 10,000 years old and brought in the lost civilization of Atlantis and all of that, right?
We reversed that. That is the reason that Zahi and Mark let me do the documentary.
Because
just came out, and they were so freaking pissed. This nonsense. So one of the key themes in my show is addressing that.
Okay.
Why the Charlton Heston and Robert Schock or whatever the guy was, because the whole argument was water erosion on the Sphinx and wind erosion proves that it was 10,500 years old, not 4,500 years old. And it's all a load of bollocks. And it's a different size.
So, okay. So this is all dealing with that. And can we still get this documentary, Neil? Is it available where documentaries are available? Is it on Amazon?
Super rate at your local bodega. I don't know where you get it anymore.
Well, have you looked on Amazon to see if it's available for purchase?
I don't know anymore. I mean, it was made for TLC, the Learning Channel.
Title? Because I see Amber typing.
Saving the Sphinx, 1997, 1998.
Well, let me tell you that Charlton Heston documentary is no friend of mine, because anytime I meet a boomer, I almost said doomer, but you know, what's the difference? And say that I'm an Egyptologist, the first thing I get is the Sphinx is 10,000 years old because Charlton Heston told me it is. And then I have to go through this whole thing about how that image of a lion was cut out of living rock, that it's still a living rock connected to the plateau. It's not Mason rebuilt, though it looks like it in some ways. And that it would have been a rock outcropping that had lion-like features that were then perfected and added to over time. And probably was a bit of a knife in the heart of people who were indigenous and who lived in the area. Even when Khufu carved his, if it's Khufu or Khafre, that's a big discussion too we can have. But when he carved his likeness into it, it would have been the Mount Rushmore type moment where you're taking something sacred, something that has been on the landscape for not just millennia, but for tens of thousands of years, for hundreds of thousands of years. It's a piece of stone that happens to look, we assume, at one point like a lion. And then for some dude who's going to, you know, be on this earth for 50 years or so to carve his face in it is kind of, you know, it's some real fucking hubris. But we take that face as the original in so many instances rather than
look like it. And also it's worth mentioning too, the reason the erosion is it's different layers of stone. Right. So if you look at the Sphinx today, it's three different layers. The bottom has what I call cladding stone, as you know. And that cladding stone is bricks they put because that's the softest layer. The hardest layer is actually the head, which is why that's the place that's carved so well. And that's in better shape. So even when I was there in the 90s, before they restored it, a gust of wind would come along. And it was in such dodgy shape that pieces of stone the size of potato chips would flutter off it.
Neil, but that just shows you that Atlantis was, you know, that's supposed to be water erosion. That can only be water erosion, we are told by Charlton.
Underwater, that doesn't happen, like Atlantis. Once you bring it out of Atlantis, then it all falls apart. And there is this sense now, obviously, we won't get into everything else, if everything's a conspiracy, but people love the idea that the Sphinx and the pyramids simply couldn't have been made by a culture from that time period, and certainly not Africans, you know.
Right.
We'll go down that road, but yeah. But again, to bring it back to saving the Sphinx, the main reason that a 21-year-old kid or whatever the hell I was allowed to do this was they were so incensed by this Charlton Heston, Moses saying that the Sphinx was made by people from Alpha Centauri, or even a culture. The whole theory was what? that a culture looks exactly like ancient Egypt, existed 10,000 years ago, built the Sphinx, and then disappeared for 5,000 years ago to be replaced by another culture that looked just like it.
Well, and if you throw in, because I remember, and I've only watched this documentary once and I vomited the whole way through metaphorically, if Atlantis built this Sphinx and is responsible for the pyramids and all these other things, and they flirted with these ideas, then this comes from classical sources and Atlantis being the precursor for the Greek world. And so it really does reassign the ownership and the responsibility and the genius for building the pyramids and the Sphinx to a Northern European, not Northern European, a European and Northern from Egypt culture, and a far more ancient one, but a far whiter one. And so the racism and the white supremacy are visible for all to see if you just do a tiny bit of digging into what Atlantis is meant to be. Yeah. And this whole water erosion thing is so very frustrating because wind erosion, as you say, you can document it. You can see when the rock is, there are parts of rock that are in great shape. There are parts of rock that are not in great shape. So rock is going to break down at different rates depending on how that rock was created itself. And limestone is, it's a bunch of dead things that are pressed down into something that gets so hard that you can carve it, that you can walk on it. It's this hard rock-like thing, but some of it's going to be softer than others. And so you're going to have layers that come apart in different ways. Again, I'm no geologist. You have more geological expertise at the Giza Plateau, I think, than most. And you were able to dig into these things. So, yeah.
And also think about television. We all know where you place the camera. There's certain images people want to see and they don't. You know, when you look at Stonehenge, you lose the motorway behind it. When you look at the Sphinx, you point up the hill, not down the hill. You avoid the modern city of Cairo, Nasrat al-Saman right there. And that was one of the big problems was the drainage from Nasrat al-Saman, this village that was growing at an exponential rate. Then they finally cleaned it up a bit. The water, that polluted water, was coming into the limestone of the Sphinx and was making it wet, and that was creating a lot of the erosion. So it was the reason it was falling apart at such a quick rate was modern problems.
So in some ways it is water erosion, not
water and wind.
Yeah, but not Atlantean water.
Sadly,
erosion.
It didn't get back to it was not the Mediterranean and it's off Santorini. It was just toilet water from Cairo.
But my favorite thing to do with the boomer is to say, well, of course the Sphinx is far older than 4,000 years old. It's hundreds of thousands of years old. And then they just look at me and I go, do you not know how rock formations work? I mean, it is an ancient thing, and it is a sacred ancient thing that was then claimed and marked. And that marking is the most interesting thing to me, but that's pretty cool. Amber, you looked it up and I have here, it's saying that saving the Sphinx is there in the IMDb, but it doesn't look like you can stream it, which is very sad.
So many hours. I've worked on over 1,000 hours of TV or something. And I used to save VHS copies back in VHS was a thing. And after a while, I think my husband finally threw them out because they live in a one-bedroom apartment. You just can't stack them up. It's a very ephemeral, transient creative process that I do. You just don't save all those things. And unless the network or the production company makes some saves and they just go away. And this, yeah. I was part of the things because the first one that I did, and it was so exciting, and I went down the secret passage and the rump of the Sphinx and all that stuff. I saw incredible stuff. We talk about how wonderful it is. These doors are opening for people, and certainly there. And again, I haven't done tons, and I've probably worked on maybe a dozen shows in Egypt over the years. That one will always be special because it was the first. Yeah. And what a lucky kid I was to start my career like that.
Yeah. And then what's your next favorite Egypt documentary? If you had to rank.
Then I jump way ahead to one of the more recent ones, merely again, because I saw so much stuff that is incredible. I won 2 years ago with Discovery about the lost city, quote unquote, that Zahi found in near the Valley of the Queens. And it was fascinating because I really petitioned hard for that one. A good friend of mine, Katerine Tironi, who's a producer who made it, she was so passionate about it. She was putting her own money to lock the site down. And the network, in often cases, they only want the gold, the shiny gold. They want the gold, nothing else. And this was, at first, what it just looked like a bunch of mud brick buildings and little more. So Discovery kept passing and passing and Geographic passed. But I went over there on my own dime, and I walked around it and saw he showed us around because it was his dig, and Katerina was convinced it was much more. And then I got a call from her like a month later, and they had found an entire other section, and it was no longer just a small little village. It's a city. It's a vast city. Have you seen it yet? Have you gone to it?
I haven't gone in. I've seen things from the outside and I've seen many images and I've seen documentaries, but I haven't gotten to go in. No.
It's, I don't know if it's open yet to the public because it's an academic luxury site. But again, you can see it right from the road. If you go to the West Bank of Luxor and you're going to go right to the Valley of the Kings, left to the Valley of the Queens, it's right there in the roundabout. And it is a huge city. And we know that Egypt doesn't really have cities left for us to explore.
Yeah.
You see the tombs and the temples, but not the everyday stuff. We have what? Dir Medina on the hill. And the thinking is now that this site actually connects to Dir Medina. It's so big that it goes all the way from the foothills, all the way up that hill and connects to the worker city of Dir Medina. They haven't dug that far yet, obviously, but it is a vast city. So being there and why I was there, they found another room. And inside this room was the strangest thing because it was, they know this new kingdom, probably from Thutmose's time, King Tut's grandfather, the third. Which Thutmose was
that? There's a Thutmose the fourth, probably. That's probably who you're thinking of. It's Amenhotep the third's father.
Thutmose the fourth? Yeah, Akhenaten's father. Who was that?
Akhenaten's father would be Amenhotep the third.
Amenhotep. So they think it was his time period. But we found one room when we were there and they were digging furiously because it was mud brick. And I wish I had images to show you. And if people can Google that, they can find it. And there's these wavy serpentine walls rather than straight walls. And they think that was just to make more space. But while we were there, they had just found a room where all the windows had been blocked up. There were two or three windows and they, through different stone, had been in antiquity because it hadn't been found. This hasn't been looked at yet, hadn't been seen yet for thousands of years. So somebody, we assume, bricked up these windows before they fled.
Right, before they closed it up. You see similar things at Amarna. When the city is abandoned, they block up the windows of the homes. They blocked up the thresholds. They closed it all up. Then they walked away. But the assumption is they're trying to keep the sand out. They're trying to keep it so that it's not going to just fall apart so that you can come back and do something with it, ostensibly. But yeah, so it was blocked up and then people walked away. Or do you think they blocked it up to do something inside?
Well, one theory is, and again, it's just a theory, because during the time period, it could have been Akhenaten who says, we're moving to Amarna.
Right.
Pack up your things.
Right.
Close the shutters. We're moving north.
I think it's a very reasonable assumption. Yeah.
Don't know that. And they have found signets and rings from both Akhenaten's time and Tut's time. So Tut did come back and he reopened it. But then it got all up by the sand. It's a huge enigma. It's a wonderful thing. And they haven't found anything more. Again, just to show that it was abandoned quickly, in another room, they found the remnants of a slipper trimmed in gold. It was a gold slipper that was left behind. Now, if somebody was doing this slowly, they would have taken gold threaded slippers with them. So, and this is all rotten and there wasn't much to see. So again, I'm curious what you think with Emmy. Why would someone leave behind a golden slipper?
I think that they're probably burying it to come back and get later because that's cash. And so you're hoarding something. You're going to put it in a hole, hide it someplace. And then you die off in Amarna because, you know, they stayed there a lot longer than 12 years, some years, longer than you would like. And maybe you die there. You can't come back and get the gold that you left behind. And it's forgotten only for archaeologists to find when they're digging through it. So that's what I would assume. So much more needs to be done with this. I know they've called it a golden city, lost city, other things, but as you call it, an extension of Dir Medina, it's so interesting because, you know, I'm working on a volume right now with a colleague, Alizé Devilliers, and it's about art and power and how the creation of art objects, whether it be an architectural space of monumental size or a very discreet but highly ornate architectural space or a statue or a stela or a tomb or a coffin. All of this art is meant to manufacture power for the people who make it. And this city, town, village, whatever you want to call it, is an installation of work spaces, little factories, little goldsmith areas, little or big areas to work on the statuary. I also, and we mentioned this last time, I think that as a part of this craft installation, you had a stoneworking area where all of the statues of the Sekhmets, or at least other granodiorite pieces for Amenhotep III's Komal Hatan mortuary temple, were worked. And you have a debitage field right there. So you have like an artisan's Shangri-La, or a Shangri-La for people like me who study artisans and artists, right there. And yeah, it's pretty extraordinary how important the creation of art was for the ancient Egyptians. And I mentioned this point in my book, The Good Kings, that the ancient Egyptians, unlike people in ancient Rome, ancient Greece, ancient Mesopotamia and Syria, that they didn't put their research and development into weaponry and how to kill people more easily, mostly because geographically they didn't have to, certainly not in the Bronze Age, in this time period that you're looking at. It's hard to invade from the outside, and there's enough bread and beer to keep pretty drunk and fat on the inside for the most part. But they did put a huge amount of R&D into how to impress people's minds and how to make their divinity seem unassailable and unquestionable. And so art in Egypt has so much power that you have just found a city that's all about its creation, its perfection, and perfecting thereby the rulers of Egypt. So I think it's one of the coolest things in the world. And I wish I knew a whole hell of a lot more about it. And, you know, someday I'll get there.
I hope you release all that stuff. I'll be hopefully they'll publish and stuff like that. I don't know where it is now. But it's also true. It shows you it's an industry too. On top of that, you know, it's not just the pharaohs. It's all the noblemen and noblewomen and stuff. Mm-hmm. Dyeing was big business, and there were so many artisans. We know that from, you know, in Jerome Medina, which was clear they were all in service of the kings.
Did you just say dyeing was big business?
Yeah.
I love that. And I would rephrase it to burying is big business. That the pageantry of funerary ritual and thereby showing all the shit you've got, that is big business. And that's going to make it such that you can separate yourself from everybody else and say, I am a god, even if you're an elite. Your body's mummified. You have a coffin. You've called yourself Osiris. Can they do that? Hells no. You are a god and they are not. And so it's a really extraordinary weapon of the mind that the Egyptians excelled at creating, which makes me want to come back to your obsession with Egypt, because as our listeners know, I am also obsessed with Egypt. I know it's a troubling thing
for you now.
It's a troubling thing. And they're listening, and they're listening to this podcast, which means you too, dear listener, are obsessed with ancient Egypt. And so let's hit this topic. Like, why do we care so much? What's this about for you? Let's start with you.
I think partially it's what you were just talking about. It is so unique compared to the other cultures, because it is this business of dying. It's this business of the other world. And if you look at it, it does feel otherworldly. There's a reason why people look, they don't look at the Colosseum or the Parthenon and say aliens built that.
No, they do not.
We can see that. We can look at that. We can see
strong Roman men built that shit. Precisely. Come on.
The sweat and brawn of great men. Exactly. And
yeah.
Egypt, there's an otherworldliness about it, and partially it's because of the art and architecture around it, because it is all about death and about mummification and about these odd gods with jackal heads. It feels like aberration is too strong a word, because clearly Mesopotamia and other early cultures are doing it too, but it stands apart, Egypt. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And certainly that was a great appeal for me, I think, because it was so odd.
Yeah.
It remains odd. It remains unknowable. And even if we can study it and study and look at it, and we can find the mundane things about it, and we clearly know, you and I, who've done so much digging and films over there, the ordinary people just like us, and that's what I want to write my books or do my films. I want to talk about the stonemasons and stuff, and not the soothsayers. But there's something that still captures the imagination that Egypt is above or separate from everything else. And partially it's because of all this crazy stuff. You go into these tombs and you go down Seti's tomb, and just festooned with the Book of the Gates and the Book of the Dead and all these strange images of snakes attacking solar boats. And
a tunnel at the end that has no end. Seti's tomb is the longest tomb. And there's a documentary. Were you part of that documentary of Seti's tomb?
I made a documentary. It was over there when they were doing the restoration. It was a lovely archaeologist.
But you didn't do the one where Zahi goes down the tunnel for Seti's tomb and they can't actually find the end and they have to turn around because
I didn't do that one.
Yeah, I mean, it's collapsing on them, this tunnel. And they're obviously trying to dig, I think, to the water table. They're trying to dig down to the noon. They're trying to create an entrance into the other spaces. Seti's tomb is one of the most extraordinary things there is on the planet.
Amazing. But
let me give you a little of my...
Yeah, forgive me.
We're all obsessed and we're all trying to figure it out. It's funny that Egyptologists don't ever ask each other why they study Egypt because they know there's no answer. They know
they're
all
by the answer because it comes, it's emotional, right? And we
yes.
can't be.
No, we're not supposed to. We're scientists. We can't say that. Oh, I've loved this since I was a child. I mean, you can say that shit. That's fine. But it doesn't really explain it. And so we don't ask each other because it's too close. It's like, you know, it's kind of like, why did you fall in love with your partner? You don't ask that of people, right? You kind of do, but not really. Because it is like a love affair. And it's a love affair that it doesn't always treat you well. And I'll tell you why I think. So obviously I wrote a whole book about this called The Good Kings, and our dear listeners can check that out. But Egypt for me is, it's like a materialized shamanism, animism. So if we go to an indigenous culture, say we were able to be here in California 500 years ago, and we were able to talk to the tongues of people and be a part of their rituals, and their shaman would lead us through mind altering and soul elevating experiences that help us to connect our material human meat suit, if you like, with some higher plane in some way, right? But Egypt has that shamanism, but it's one of the only places in the world that has systematically materialized it in temple form, stone temple form, statuary form, and has gone further and politicized it and taken the shaman and made him the king, made him the one in charge of everything, and made his initiation into political rule also an initiation, or primarily an initiation, into dwelling and connecting and communicating with the gods, nothing less. And that is, shamanism is something that we are increasingly interested in modern late capitalist society, as we're all working three jobs and really upset about our lives and what is there out there. And people are all microdosing and ketamining and trying to find their lost child and whatever it is. We're very interested in lost indigenous ways of doing things. And Egypt presents that as a possibility. And I don't want to discount that Egypt's religious abilities, beliefs, and its shamans were not true initiated masters, but its ability to co-opt and subvert using that extraordinary power was considerable. And so we're attracted to that too, because we're like, oh my God, you know, I could connect with gods and all of that, but I could also be king of the world. And so if you want
to, and I remember reading your book, and then that was something you really struggled with, because it's absolute power and it's despotic and it's everything we were against. And right. Yet we look back at these great Ramses, the great Sanaknatans, and we just think they're the cat's meow. And right. Yet they're awful human beings. So how right. do you reconcile that?
It's the bully you love. But then if he's an initiated shaman, is he a bully? He's got something you will never understand that he can't share with you, nor would he ever. And we want that information. We want the name of the god, right? If we're going to Setna Kamwas, and how do you gain power? You get the name of the god and then you have control over your own fate and your own destiny, whatever. We desperately want these things in a world where we have little control, but at the same time, we want that material excess and success. And we see Egypt as like this means of getting to it. And I don't think this is a very Jungian psychological way of going about why everyone is so fucking obsessed with Egypt, but it's because they are. They keep watching this stuff and they want to know more. And I, some lowly Egyptologist, will get more attention than somebody who's studying ancient Byzantine culture, because who wants to know about Byzantine? They weren't shamans.
Yeah,
they didn't
connect. The Byzantines and the Romans and the Greeks, they had their despots too. I mean, there were Caligulas everywhere. I mean, no matter where you look, they're awful leaders. So what is it about Egypt that sets them apart?
Right. Well, and Rome, we just went through that whole memeing experience of how many times a day do you think about ancient Rome, dear white man? And that was really entertaining, right? And then there was a counter meme, which is women think about astrology in Egypt. But let me tell you, the demographics will prove you wrong, because most of the people who are interested in ancient Egyptian culture, who were on my Facebook when I was active there before they monetized it and destroyed it, you know, it was all white men. It was mostly boomers and above. And so that's, it's not just men love Rome, men love Egypt too. Rome is, as you say, built by men, died there, and it's all of the worldly things. And Romans were obsessed with Egypt too. They had their Isis cults underground. They connected with the Apis bull. They wanted a part of this shamanism and deep connection to the other side as well. So it's not like we're the only ones. We're just the recipients of a Roman way of thinking and way of life, trying to get back to whatever we think of as this pure originalism of safety and goodness.
We emulate Roman thinking, we see ourselves in it. And yet Egypt, even to the Romans, was something, again, that was abstract and odd and otherworldly, again, which is why, the aliens built the pyramids.
Which is why I've told everyone this before, and I'll tell you again, pick up your golden ass, because I know you can get a copy of it online for nothing. Get a copy of Apuleius' Golden Ass and read about it. Did you really? It's the most fun, novel.
It is so much fun.
And it's all about this, all the trials and travails of this dude who's just trying to make it in the world, just trying to make it in his own version of a late capitalist Roman world. Everyone's against him and he can't get a break. And there's women coming after him and rich men. And he's like, what the fuck is this? And then he finds God, but not just any God, right? He finds the true shamanistic way of working to get to the other side, the Egyptian goddess Isis, and follows her and goes down, goes through all of the different steps of initiation. And what is at the end of the golden ass? But Osiris, the true face of divinity. And it is a body sexual, like it'll make you blush, this book. And yet it is so earnest
and
at the end.
It's funny. It's the eternal ass. We see ourselves in this character. And I did a lot of ancient Rome because I'm just finishing a book now that takes place in Rome about Pompeii. And if you've been to Pompeii, one of the highlights of going to Pompeii is the Temple of Isis. Have you been there? And
yes.
Gorgeous little temple shrine right there. And clearly it had patronage at the time, and it was one of the first things they excavated, apparently, when Mozart went there. And that was one of the things. Even then, there was something about, even in the Greco-Roman world, there was something fascinating about finding Isis within it. And that temple clearly was so venerated that the fact that it was still alive and kicking in 79 AD, this ancient goddess, it's fascinating. It just showed that's the last power of Egypt. And that's why we see ourselves in Rome and Greece. I don't think a lot of people necessarily see themselves in Egypt, but we're fascinated what they know that we didn't.
I think Egypt, for us to love it or her, if we want to make it Isis, or him, if we want to make it Osiris, if we want to personalize it. But for us to love Egypt, it has to be dead. Because if it's alive, and if we see it as a living entity, Rome is almost a living entity. The city of Rome still functions. We still call it Rome. And the language is so very similar. Egypt, your language is gone. They're speaking Arabic. The Egyptian language is lost, right? From an elite replacement of a bunch of Arabs coming in and forcing a massive change. But because Egypt is dead and you can venerate it, you can divinize more easily when you can idealize and perfect it. And you're not suffering from its sins and vagaries. And so Egypt can be this idealizing Atlantean sort of place, can be, right, for us. And so we can go there and find some sort of perfection. And then when I write The Good Kings, people are like, fuck you, you've destroyed my idealized dead space, and you've made it come alive, and I hate you for it. And I get that, because it is this way of living in the past, a perfected idealized past, and making whatever it is great again that you need to make great.
Egypt feels lost. I mean, when I think about it, one of the other things that I was always fascinated, even before I started reading about Egypt, that always struck an emotional chord was the paintings of David Roberts.
Because
he's showing these ruins of Philae and Elephantine Island or whatever, or whatever temple he's showing. And they're standing alone. They are half swallowed by sand. They are anonymous and silent. There's no modern city. There's one shepherd and a goat, and that is
right.
it. Right. How romantic is that? The sense of a culture that is in front of us but has no reference points to anything they came after it. You can't go to Rome or Athens and see that.
No, you can't. And there is there is a woke backlash against David Roberts' paintings, Neil, if you did not know this, because now people are saying, so you can't have, you can't idealize a David Roberts painting because they're removing the living people from the antiquity. Yes, there's a guy and a goat, but mostly it's people-less, and he's idealizing it by removing that these spaces continued into medieval, or in his case, or these early industrial times in Egypt. And it's a European colonial image of what we want Egypt to be rather than what Egypt is. So, and while I'm ambivalent, I did use the word woke, which obviously has become quite derogatory. It is an image of its time, but it is that Egypt that we all long for. It's that perfected Egypt that's not real. And it is an Egypt that I largely reject in my work, but it's the Egypt that you in your work have to put forward front and center as the only thing that really exists.
I think people do want to see, you don't want to go too raw and gritty with the films that I make. Like I say, you want to focus up the hill at Giza, not down the hill, because people right. don't want to see the modern traffic circle.
I love that talking about that there's a fucking KFC right there and that we should talk about that. That's like one of my favorite things, that life goes on around this thing and that the living are all clustered around this. And I don't know, it's the anthropologist in me, but that's super interesting.
It is. But again, I think certainly for storytelling, for armchair travel, and I don't want to say everybody, I don't want to lump all viewers as a different perspective than what we, you know, who go to the field and see is different. But They want to be transported. They want to be transported to another place that is not downtown Cincinnati. They want to feel like they're in another friggin' world. And the David Roberts world and seeing Kumombo right there and nothing else around it or whatever, that takes them there. Yeah. Rather than showing the Ramsey statue in Tahrir Square with a traffic jam around it. You know,
yeah.
that's part of Egypt too, but that's not the one that is exotic. And I think exotic definitely has a bad name, and I reckon the connotation, but I do recognize when I make my films or write my books, people want to be transported a bit to that. You have to be respectful. And I think that simply means make sure you have modern Egyptian characters and talk about the real world as well. But the reason Indiana Jones are so popular is because people do want that escapism. And I think I'd rather people escape into that fantasy than a sci-fi fantasy or kind of the world. You get people excited about walking into a tomb underneath Cairo or whatever, and it has some semblance, in fact, that's so much closer to reality than in creating a total fiction. It's wonderful because then people can go out and find the real thing. I never pretend the films that I make are the be and end all. Hopefully, if anyone's really curious, they're not going to stop at one of my films. They're going to be really interested in like the Ptolemaic times. They'll go out and read a proper book. Some do, some don't.
It's super interesting that this conversation, more than any conversation I've ever had, has helped me to verbalize why I don't do TV anymore.
Thanks.
Oh my God.
I put the nail in the coffin, the last nail in the coffin.
I mean, if I'm going to do it again, it has to be in a way that makes these ancient people come alive, because that's what I feel I need to do, and not romanticize them within an inch of their lives such that they cease to exist as real people. For whatever reason.
But let me counter that. Is romanticizing really so bad? Is it that evil? Is it that disservice to romanticize something? As long as we still have the facts elsewhere, what's the harm in a little romance?
Because romance is ideology, and ideology is getting me to believe something for a particular reason. And then I want to know what the fuck you're trying to get me to believe and why, and what it is you're trying to not get me to see. So yes, I will double down on this and say that romanticizing is bad. We've romanticized the Roman Empire. We've romanticized the Greek Alexandrian Empire, and we've romanticized the Greek city-states before that. We've romanticized Sparta, we've romanticized Athens. None of it was as we think it was, and romanticizing it makes us...
You romanticize the hippie movement, or you romanticize the 50s as well. This is not an apology
for
it.
That's right.
That's what we do once we march on from the time.
But we never march on. When you romanticize it, then you think you can make it great again. You can go back. You can find a way to rebuild what you have lost. And then you can harangue people and lament and gnash your teeth about all that you have lost, because you have this romanticized past that we should be living in. And so the romanticization, if I'm going to get Marxist with it, and I think you can, functions very well for those at the top of a social pyramid trying to maintain a status quo. It works really well. And it works well because then they get to claim a past as it functions for them. And so a romanticized Rome or Greece is going to work for nation states who are not Rome or Greece if they base their governments on some semblance of democracy or a tribunal government or whatever. And we see the repercussions of that romanticization. And I think it would be, it's a little more hard to pin down with Egypt why a romanticization is harmful, but pin it down, I will try. Maybe not in this moment, but it's, well, I mean, I wrote a book about it. I wrote The Good Kings, trying to grapple with that, right? So that's me trying to say, what is the price you will pay for this thing you are doing? And the pushback is fine. And people will continue to romanticize or tell me that this stuff must stay apolitical. But apolitical history is romanticized history, because history is as dirty as you can possibly imagine and always has been. There is no clean historical humanity.
Look, history is escapism too. There's a reason that why you do what you do and I do what I do. I don't think we have to feel bad about romanticizing anything about the past if we can tell a good story. See, I guess because I'm a storyteller, yes, it can be abused and manipulated, and it is in the wrong hands, and of which there are many. All this can be turned against us. But if it's just a paperback you're picking up and you're going to read a love story about Cleopatra, or you're going to read about 300 and repelling all the Persians, clearly you can look at all the negative stuff there, or it can just be a fun escape for somebody sitting there. And on its own, I don't want to dismiss that, because that's what almost all stories, the Westerns, you know, I grew up with The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, and Lawrence of Arabia, and Seven Samurai. They're my three favorite films. And you could definitely look at them and break them down and see how offensive it is to Japanese, to Mexicans, and to Arabs. But they're also just fun escapism. And I don't think necessarily on an individual level, as someone who loves to be transported and taken away, I think there's great value in that escape.
But then there has to be a line drawn between the storytelling and the history writing. And what you have done with documentaries, and I'm not blaming you in any way. This is just a whole zeitgeist and a whole world that is breaking apart, and we should hit that next. But this history storytelling, whether it's on television or film or streaming, it is blurring the lines between an idealized romantic version of history and the actual history, because it's not a rigorous grappling of the data with the data in any way. It's picking and choosing what data you want. It's saying, this is going to make the best story. Oh, that thing that person said, this little off color, I don't get it. We're going to cut that out. And it's you deciding which parts of the story you're going to put forward. And so then it's not history, but it's presented as such. And there I'm like, and that's where I gnash my teeth. and I'm like, what the hell? Yeah.
And certainly television and documentaries is a different thing, because certainly I can say from my perch as a network executive for 15 years, there's a lot of things we dismiss sometimes because they don't rate. We don't do the Civil War, whatever reason, it doesn't rate. You know, actually, we dismiss entire time periods, whatever.
It's funny because the Civil War used to rate so high when I was growing up, you know, the gray and the blue and everything. And there was like a reboot of a lot of Gone with the Wind stuff. I mean, in the 80s, the Civil War was as hot as could be, and that's all people watched. And there was, you know, tons of books written about the Civil War, and there was that Matthew Broderick movie, Glory, about the Civil War. I mean, it was huge in the 80s, early 90s, maybe. And then zeitgeist changes, it stops. Nobody wants to fucking discuss how the America was at each other's throats, probably because they were starting to really be at each other's throats.
That's just one of the reasons why a lot of it is, you know, clearly you talk about woke and everything else, working in the networks, you'd be cautious about who is consuming our stories. Yeah. Because the film we make isn't for world consumption, but mostly domestic. So it has to play Alabama as well as it plays New York City. So we question about what we bring into or we don't bring into it. Do we mention Robert E. Lee or don't we mention? So that's one of the ways why we don't touch those things. But to your point,
you first and then I'll spend.
And I agree the shift towards documenting the responsibility there, which is, it's tough. Certainly when it's being produced by network, it's the same old stories over and over and over again. And people are afraid to tell stories about something they may not rate as well or less known. That's why we have so many Cleopatra stories.
So tedious.
It's so tedious. It's like, I'm so sick of seeing, you know, Alex, Anthony and Cleopatra die. I'm just like, oh, let them die.
Yeah, but you know why they tell Cleopatra again and again. And I've made this point in my book, When Women Rule the World. It's because they have a cautionary tale against women ruling. And who's the demographic consuming so much of this shit? White women who support the patriarchy, or men who don't want women to rule and would love to watch a story about how she fucked it up over and over and over again.
She got her comeuppance, right?
And that's right. Why, and even a Stacey Schiff Yeah, even a Stacey Schiff reboot or the Netflix reboot that was just out. Even these things where they're saying they're, it's a feminist recasting of Cleopatra and seen through a different lens. It's really not. They take the same Roman story, the same tired Roman story. They don't doubt the fact that she made all these decisions for all these emotional reasons and that she committed suicide at the end. They never doubt the Roman storytelling that is given to us. And it's it all of this stuff, whether it's Cleopatra or Tut again and again and again, is all meant to, it's an ideology of making us feel good about the world that we live in now and making us not have to think. It's more passivity. And if there's any conspiracy theories in there, like the Sphinx being 10,000 years old because of water erosion on the side or whatever, it's something else to make us feel superior to ancient peoples and help us lay claim through Atlantis or whatever that it's really ours and we did it. Or I mean, it, yeah.
The solution of the antidote is, how should these stories be told?
Okay, so now we're, okay, so, I mean, Neil, we're jumping into this moment. I mean, you're talking to me now and you have time to talk to me now because Discovery and Nat Geo and History are not making the kinds of shows that you used to make, right? And now, and we're going to talk about this later, but now you're a novelist and you're writing awesome books and we'll discuss, but we're now in a moment where we have to, and so many things are like this, social media is, and really finding community online is changing very rapidly. Oh, the university system is changing very rapidly. Government is changing very rapidly. And as everything changes very rapidly, this consumption of idealized storytelling is also not, no matter how many times you churn out the same fucking Cleopatra and Tut story, it's not doing it anymore. It's like another Marvel movie. How many Marvel movies have we had? Really, I'm done. Another Tolkien spinoff. I've seen all the Hobbits and whatever, and you've destroyed it. And it's just, it's become a same old, same old, same old. And the public is like, yeah, I would rather, like my husband, watch some person go through a thrift store in Tokyo and pick things up and say what period it is and, oh, I'm going to buy this and watch them haggle for it. And he's more interested in that real human thing than... And I think a lot of people are and are doing their YouTube curation.
He doesn't want all the curated. He just wants information. And then in 1214, the Armada did this.
Yeah.
You know, with the facts.
And what do you do, Neil? You cut to a thing of water. Like, you watch the way these guys do these.
Oh, they're so ropey the way they made it. Just, it's the same shot of, like, you know, someone looked out their window and shot Lake Michigan or whatever. And suddenly this becomes a Spanish Armada.
I know. And we've all been in those moments. If you've done any TV production, as I have, and you go out and you get some fucking water because you're like, we are crossing the waters. So, like, I need some B-roll of water. You go get some water. But with AI, I mean, we have the ultimate tools available for us that is soon, like within the year, we're going to have video AI, right? And we have image AI.
That story was a couple of weeks ago, I think what was his name? Tyler Perry Studio, whatever. Did you hear about that in Atlanta? And he decided not to build a studio.
Yeah.
He can do it all digitally. He doesn't have to go to whatever. And it looks so good now that that's killing tons of, I have friends in Cairo and in Europe, and they do location work when they come over. They're the gaffers and the fixers, and they make money every time someone comes over and they want to shoot at the plateau, whatever. They got money. Now you don't have to go there. You can shoot it all in Atlanta, and it looks
the
same. So it's killing out of the industry, but it also makes people wonder just what is real and what's not. Then do you like the color of the pyramid? I mean, that's a whole other, you know, AI is a whole other topic. We have to leave probably for six other podcasts, but clearly my business is going to suffer exponentially and already has, because you do not need to go on location.
I want to throw in a little side anecdote because I think it's important. As we're talking about the perfection of history, the state of Egypt, the Ministry of Antiquities, as it works right now, has gone on a campaign probably since, I mean, you were talking about the Sphinx, but I would say really in earnest for the last 10 years of perfecting and idealizing the Egyptian landscape, such that you go to the Step Pyramid at Saqqara and you're like, wait, it's not even a ruin anymore. It's been rebuilt. It's got like these straight sides and it looks like ass.
People movers inside and everything.
It's horrible. It's horrible. And it's like some Disney horror show where the antiquity isn't even there anymore, that they took the oldest monumental structure on earth. They hired two companies, I think three, to come in and fuck it up. And so now it looks like something that it is not. And now it's like an AI pyramid. in a sense. It's like, oh, you've over perfected it. You've over romanticized it. And the zeitgeist is shifting and fast, because what people are going to want is human messiness, human authenticity, human things that the computers cannot do. They'll figure it out. But if it's something they can't do in the moment, then it's something that we will be attracted to, because all of this idealization, storytelling, perfecting, romanticization, AI's got this shit down, and it will become so boring. It already has. It is so boring to us that people are going to be like, yeah, I don't need to go to Saqqara. Or you look at it, you go, where's the pyramid? I don't get it. Do they undo it? I don't know the answer to these things. But, you know, and it really jumped the shark, for those of you who are old enough to know that Fonzie reference, when Waziri stood in front of the smallest of the great pyramids at Giza and said he will reclad it, or parts of it, with a red granite cladding. And people lost their minds, who'd never been to Egypt. And they're like, how dare you ruin our antiquity? And all of these colossi are going up all over the place. What, are they going to take the colossus in front of the Memnon, in front of the Ramesseum, and stand it back up again, and you lose your Shelley poem? I don't know. Maybe.
Could do.
But like, they could. And these things are very interesting and make me think that TV is dying as we know it. This idealizing documentary, infodrama, I might call it, sort of TV is dying in favor of what? I'm not sure. And I don't think it's even like, you know, I wrote down a bunch of personalities on my little notepad in front of me. I've got Zahi Hawass, Josh Bernstein, Chris Naunton, Josh Gates, Sarah Parcak, Mary Beard, if we go off to Rome. Those are mostly personalities that work with Egypt or archaeology in general. And are we sticking with that anymore? Because you and I know what it means to be such a personality and how highly idealized, scripted, and airbrushed, in a sense, these people are. They may not, I'm not saying you're airbrushed on your documentary, but what you say and how you say it is a show. You know, your show, it's showmanship. And, you know, you're doing the shiny thing over here. Everyone look. And I've done this. I hosted a TV show. I know what it means to fill those shoes and to be able to do that. But I don't know if we want that anymore
either. I think that in a way that's, I wouldn't say it's dying, because if you can still get a super big celebrity, I think some of the ones you mentioned now that are not big, I work with Morgan Freeman on some
content. Yeah.
You get something like Morgan Freeman, you show up to see Morgan Freeman.
Yeah.
But a lot of these kind of shows of the walk and talks of an archaeologist, the Mary Beard like stuff, or the Chris Nyland stuff, they're still doing them, but they're not doing as much, I think, because they do feel inauthentic and they feel very old school.
Mm-hmm.
And also, too, on a larger perspective, it shifts the POV. And I think that's what it made it so cozy for so many people, sipping their tea, watching it, you know, when it's Bettany Hughes or whatever, taking a trip down the Nile in a boat and talking about it.
I forgot that's Bettany. Yeah, you're right. You're right. Yeah.
So we're looking out at her and we're seeing her experience. And here's a wonderful stonemason I want to introduce you to. It becomes her Egypt. And I guess that's fine because it's personality driven, but it does take it away from the real thing, which is Egypt. And I love what you said earlier, and I hadn't thought about this till now. What would the blowback be to all this AI world where everything is manufactured and so clean and so smooth, where we're not even sure what's real, or we have to question it? Will people revolt and say, well, just give me the messiness? I want to see the trash-filled tomb in Giza, and I want to see it as it is, and I want to see it. I want to live vicariously through somebody that is not presenting a David Roberts-like world. Will that be the reaction? I don't know. And the question is, do younger people care as much? I mean, I can't imagine Egypt will ever go out of style. It is evergreen. But I do know the shows, at least I make, one of the reasons they're dying is not just they're expensive, but the demographics, they're aging out.
Yeah.
You know, Science Channel, my network, more or less went under. Smithsonian went under. Animal Planet, which of course is more natural history, went under. And part of it is because all the viewers were like, you know, 58 and up.
Yeah.
Many people that have cable or people over 50 or whatever anymore. No one else does, but they're cutting the cord. But also too, as that demographic gets older and dies off, it's not going to be replaced by a 22-year-old kid who's going to turn on that Josh Gates show and watch it in the same way. That is old school stuff. It works for a certain audience, but it's not being replaced by a new generation.
Right.
They're going to YouTube, they're going elsewhere, but the shows that I made, that spent the last 25 years making, as I got older, so did they. And the newer viewers simply don't want stories told that way.
It's not like TikTok doesn't idealize, and it is its own youth demographic, but somebody I'm sure is out there making antiquity shows on TikTok of little bites. And that's kind of where the human brain is at right now. But this is, you know, where I'm running to and where Amber is coming with me is back to print and back to the good old fashioned tome of old, the book, to blogs. And really the podcast will be around, but it's kind of like just an informal blog, if you like. But that's where I'm going because I don't know where else to go and where else to put my ideas.
I think that there's, and then a book, at least you're going to get 400 pages of one topic. And if it's been vetted by someone who's an expert or whatever, you feel like you're in good hands.
Yeah.
And it's more selective. But again, we also know a lot of younger people don't read too.
They don't read. I mean, so we'll have to see. Does this book get chopped up? They're reading. They're just reading on their phones and they're reading shorter form. Do you then, and you know, Substack and places like that, which is where we have our platform, obviously. And thank you, dear listeners and readers. But like, are you going to break up your book into 17 different sections and then release it and then release the book too? And I can imagine a lot of these discussions people are having, but when these boomers die, which is the next 20 years, the whole media world is going to shift with them towards a millennial zeitgeist. And then everyone's going to be chasing Gen Z and Gen Alpha. And it's not like they don't watch things that are, my son only watches Community and Schitt's Creek because it makes him feel happy, comfy, and safe. And he just watches it over and over again. I don't think he's alone. So there's this idea of a safety and a comfort and just having that kind of community literally around you. But then what that means for people who make history content, and we make history content. How does that, how do we work with that? I'm not sure yet. And we'll see.
Partially, one of the key things is it comes down to commitment. You know, I make 2-hour specials a lot.
Yeah.
So few people watch a 2-hour special now. They're making less. That's kind of, if you want to do a full story about the rise and the fall of the new kingdom, whatever, you know, 2 hours is the beginning of it. You should do 8 episodes or whatever, but people won't even commit to that anymore.
No.
Both network, but also I think the younger viewers. And again, I don't want to speak for younger viewers. There's a lot of people who would, you know, devour your book and then read 6 more on it or they'll find stuff. But I think in this age of mass consumption and going on, they just want a little snippet. So how on earth do you tell a long story? How, I mean, we talk about authenticity. That is not the response to AI, and shorter and cozy is not authentic.
No, so, and I think length is a mistake. It's a mistake to chop everything up into tiny things. I think people do like to consume long things. And I just think that we're now being expected, as with everything else, to do 3 times as much with a tenth of the budget that we used to have. And I think we can do that and we can find interesting ways to do it. And it's amazing that people don't need the on-site perfectionism. They don't need like the beautifully, like maybe walking to the Sphinx from the KFC is what people want right now, actually.
No, because I think, look, if Egypt, if we're talking about the grand pole of Egypt that goes all the way back to Roman time, you're saying Nero visited apparently to go look at the Great Sphinx in like 64 AD. So that fascination there is evergreen. I can't imagine people aren't going to want that same sort of visceral, exotic, otherworldly feel, or that sense of, no matter what generation comes after us.
Yeah, but what if you can get that? But
going to be the key going forward.
But what if you, if you and I can provide that by just going into the hypostyle hall, you and me with our iPhone 15, then that's what we do. And then you don't have any actors hired wearing silly ass headgear to make people feel slightly emotional about whatever decision-making is going on 2000 years prior. We just talk about things in the way that we understand it. It's 2 people with an iPhone in a fabulous place talking about how fabulous it is and strip it down.
Yeah, passion, exactly. Because that's what, you know, it was contagious, is someone else's passion and excitement is what you pick up on, which again is probably why you have these hosts looking at the beautiful sunset of the Nile and say, isn't it wonderful? And you live vicariously through their passion. But you're just walking through the hypostyle hall and looking up and saying, oh my God, look at these forest of columns, and us getting excited. I've been here 15 times and it still gives me the chills.
Yeah.
Great thing to share with somebody too. And maybe if you can do that in 15 minutes or shorter, it's enough. Again, the hope, I never hoped that the films that I've made were the end. A lot of people watch them and they think about it. But if you're really curious about, like me, I saw my first film when I was and National Geographic, when we talked about that last time, and it was like all these aerial shots of Karnak, and I couldn't get enough. I went out and I went to the library and I got six books on it.
Yeah.
I like to think that still is going to happen,
I
whatever
hope
else.
so, if we don't stop funding libraries.
Yeah.
But one of my favorite documentaries of all time is Michael Palin's Around the World in 80 Days. And the
Oh.
reason, and it's a colonialist as fuck book, right? White guy goes out with his little brown servant who's going to help him, his passepartout, right? And he has to get around the world in 80 days. But that aside, it's wonderful because he has to figure out with the shipping master how to get on a container ship from this Red Sea port over to the tip of India, and how to get from there to, you know, it's fun because when things go wrong and are messy, people are like, oh my God, what are they going to do? That's so cool. Rather than, and again, I'll stand by it, rather than seeing the pyramid from the beautiful angle, though you could do that, juxtapose it with it from the other side and say, this is the reality. And this is how it is to live in a city with antiquities. This is what this real world is like.
And the fish out of water. And the Michael Palin obviously is very colonial, but the reason is work is again because we can see ourselves in Michael Palin more than we can in the locksmith. And right now, because the miniseries is back on TV, I remember as a kid, I'm reading Shogun for the first time.
Yeah, everyone is.
Mother
Yeah,
of Books.
it's great. Yeah,
And
Remy
it's
is
really
too.
well
Yeah.
written,
Yeah, it's great.
1975. And you could argue it's a white man's perspective of feudal Japan. But it is a rollicking good story and it is
Yeah.
smart. And the Japanese characters are smart. So, you know, it's
Richard
easy.
Chamberlain, baby. I remember when
Oh,
he, you know,
yeah,
that
he
one
was a
watched
babe.
it. Yeah. Yeah. Amber, you're not old enough to remember Richard Chamberlain playing in Shogun, are you? She's not even sitting yet.
Must have saw it free on YouTube years later. You and I cuddled up and watched the miniseries, the NBC event. And we saw it.
Do you know what I did the other day? Because I'm like, Richard Chamberlain, Shogun. Everyone's talking about Shogun. I'm like, there was this also rather colonial as fuck series, mini series called, what is it called? But it's got Ben Cross and Amy Irving, and he's in India, and he's playing a half breed, half Indian, half white man who's been adopted or something. The Far Pavilions, I remembered it. And
Watch that
I
one.
found, because I remember watching it with my parents, and I remember when Amy Irving's sister has to commit sati because she's married this older husband and he dies, and she has to throw herself on the funeral pyre, and it's and presented as this total primitive thing that only people in India would do, and we white people are no, and they shoot her so she doesn't have to suffer and whatever. That always like really hit with me. I'm like, what is this? What is this place? What is this thing? I was probably like six when I saw it. And so I bought it on Amazon.
Did you?
I am a proud owner of the Far Pavilions. And I started watching, like, wow, this is what TV was like when they shot it on film. You know, sometimes it'll be out of focus. They didn't measure appropriately. They're like,
How embarrassing is it? How colonial and how white-centered is it?
it is. And they even have some brown face in it, which is why nobody's going to be talking about it because everyone's wearing makeup. Amy Irving's got makeup. Ben Cross has got makeup so they can look as
They're
if they
both playing
are
Indian.
Indian.
Play
He
Indian.
is playing half Indian and she is playing Indian. Yes.
All right. Okay.
Yes.
All right.
And this
There's
is
a
why
twin.
our wokeness will never allow this to come back in the way that Shogun is coming back. But how different is it from Shogun? It's not really.
But
And
and again, you look at Shogun itself. You look at James Clavell was a white guy wrote this book in the 70s, and it was his perspective. I don't know if you've ever been to Japan, but he again,
I
it's a good
have.
story. But you
Yeah.
know, but it is definitely to the white man. And again, it's like it's not Kipling, but clearly it's a throwback to that kind of work. And again, you have to navigate that because as a storyteller, again, this is not an apologist for it. You want to be able to relate to somebody who takes you into that world, which is why we have the hosts and why they
Right.
don't. Anymore because people don't want all that clutter. But it's a tried and true way of going into a world because when Michael Palin figures out how to get on a boat and how to open something up, we're discovering it with him, the awkward
Right.
English and all the jokiness that comes with being a fish out of water. I'm
Right.
not saying that it is beyond reproach, it clearly isn't. But it is a way for us to relate to something that might other world feel too foreign.
Right. Right. Oh my God, this has been such a fun conversation. And before we go, I also want to hear from you about your writing because I know you've been working on a novel, and I know that novel is now, is it published? Is it
Soon to come out a
out?
couple of May, yeah. May 6th it comes out, yeah.
What's the title?
And it's the third book that I've written. It's the one that the first one that I'm publishing, and it's about Egypt as well. It takes everything we've been talking about and throws it into a book.
That's wonderful. What's the title?
called Primetime Travelers. And it deals with a film crew, a rather feckless film crew is in way over their head making an Ancient Aliens-like show. No one that I know, of course. But no, it's that kind of work. And they're in Egypt. And they have this great opportunity, instead of making this crap film, a crazy lady, sort of based on Om Seti, if you know who Seti is. She claims...
British woman who claimed to be the wife of Ramses. Oh, no, Seti the first, sorry. And mother of Ramses the second? Was she the mother?
No, she claimed to be the lover of Seti.
Right, but does she also claim to be the mother of...
I forget if she's... I don't know if she said she was reincarnated from any...
Anyway, Wikipedia her, because Wikipedia she is super famous. And I should know more, and I apologize to...
Originally, I was going to do it, but I don't realize it was much more fun to kind of write something comedic. My style is definitely very comedic, and I realize I just want... I can't take fantasy too seriously, but I can have fun with it. So this is a fantasy. It's a time travel. So this film crew does her a favor by going back into ancient Egypt to find her lover's mummy is missing in the Duat in the 12th.
Yeah.
And she will open a false door to the past, to the times of Ramses the Great, and allow them to make the best Emmy-winning documentary they ever could. If they go in the Duat, follow Ramses' tomb, or Ramses' solar boat when he dies, and look for a missing lover in the 12 gates.
So I love it that their purpose is to win the Emmy. That's so great.
Well, the purpose, exactly. And come back and make a kick-ass film. Of course, then they got other issues, and they go through the 12 gates of hell. And it's a romp, and it's definitely got a lot of the host, and there's a sound person and a camera woman and the young, naive director trying to make his claim and come out. And it all happens while they're doing this kind of fun time travel fantasy.
It sounds awesome.
I just wrote the sequel, too, which takes place in Pompeii. In the sequel, they go back to Pompeii to make the
That's
sequel.
That's awesome. That's great. Okay, that's why you were writing in Italy, and I was so jealous as you were posting, like, here on my writing retreat. I'm like, I want a writing retreat.
Here I am looking at Mount Vesuvius, having a glass of wine, writing my novel.
Just I vomited on Mount Vesuvius. I just want everyone to know this, that when I was 16 as an exchange student to Germany, we went on the German trip to Italy, and I imbibed too much and vomited red wine all over some poor girl whose name I don't remember on the bus climbing up Mount Vesuvius. So just that one of my most shameful moments.
Vesuvius story.
Yes. Well, you said wine and Vesuvius, and I had to follow it up with some non-romanticized storytelling.
You don't believe in romance. You got always
I can be romantic, but as you know, I'm more of a reality girl, as we see. But
one of the reasons I wrote the novel is because having been in the nonfiction world, and you can put air quotes around that if you want, for the last 25 years, I wanted to write something that was just absolute fun. Take everything I know. If you read this book about the Duat or ancient Egypt, but you read one about Pompeii, there's a lot of take-home information. I got stacks of books about both behind me. I know everything about the Book of the Gates. I was translating from the Coptic about the Book of the Gates. So it's all in there, but it's a romp. It is a fun romp, but I'm taking television and skewering TV and what we want to make. The networks are expecting all the stuff we're talking about, and they get in too deep. So I was able to kind of create a full fiction, but yet based on the two worlds I know, Egypt and television.
I love it. And you know that I always like to try to take down a network executive, because they're so difficult, and talk about a lack of romance or only romance in mind. And I'm like, well, this would make a great story. And they're like, no, I want more Tut. No, I want more Cleopatra.
And the day it's a business. They're paying you X amount of money to go up and do it. You know, they
Well, their business is failing.
Yes, it is. That's why I have all this time to write. Any listener out there is hiring, you know, I'll give you my phone number. Nothing else. You can read my book. You can buy my book when it's out on Amazon, but we'll talk about that later when it gets closer to the date.
Okay. That's awesome. Hey, Neil, it's been so much fun to have you on, and till next time. Yeah.
Yep. Inshallah.
Yeah. Take care, everyone. Thanks a lot. Thanks for listening to Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Thanks. Okay. Bye-bye.
Thank you to our listeners for your support, and please subscribe. If you enjoyed the show, share it with all your friends, and most importantly, leave us a 5-star review. Send all those ancient world questions and topic suggestions for future episodes to ancientnow@substack.com. We actually do read them all. You can find info on all my books, articles, and upcoming lectures on my website. Just head to karakuniegyptologist.com. Amber puts all of that together. Oh my God, thank you, Amber. Check out our Substack, Ancient Now, at ancientnow.substack.com, where we share perspectives on all that history and archaeology news every week and continue the conversations that happen after the podcast mic is turned off. Support the show by becoming a paid subscriber at our Substack Ancient Now community. This keeps the show free for everyone, and paid status gives you access to our archives. Thank you to our current supporters. I'm at all the social medias. Look for at Kara Cooney. Thanks to the team at Patina Productions for this podcast, which I must point out is wholly separate from my academic work at UCLA. See you next time on Afterlives of Ancient Egypt.